from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. This is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Peter Aronoff.
And I'm Ed Ayers. You may remember the name George Kennan. He was the Cold War era diplomat who inspired the containment policy toward the Soviet Union after World War II. But there was another George Kennan, a 19th century relative, who actually helped bring the U.S. and Russia closer together.
George Kennan was a very young man when all this began to happen. He was just barely 20, and he was working in his father's telegraph office as an operator, and he heard about the Overland Telegraph project.
This is journalist Rosemary Nearing, who wrote a book about the Overland Telegraph. As its name implies, it was a plan to connect America to Europe by wire, not across the Atlantic, but rather across the vast Asian landmass. Now, this was 1865, and Kennan was one of the many young men out west who had missed out on the adventure, as they saw it, of the Civil War, and who jumped at the opportunity to take part in a new adventure.
People hear about it. They desperately want to become part of this expedition. There was one who went on the expedition who bribed somebody else to drop out so that he could have a place.
In the Civil War years, Russia had been Washington's greatest ally. Now, with war's end, Western Union, with help from the government, had convinced Russia to cooperate on this unprecedented engineering project. The telegraph line would go up from San Francisco through British Columbia, the Yukon Territory, Russian America, also known as Alaska, across the Bering Sea to Siberia, and then more than 5,000 miles overland to Moscow. It kind of makes sense if you look at a map, but
they really did not understand the conditions in, well, I'll call it Alaska now, and in Siberia. They had no idea of the fact that communications was impossible, supply lines were going to be incredibly difficult. They had no idea about permafrost, that in order to put the poles in place, they were going to have to find somehow some sort of solid footing for them. They just really had no clue. It was not a mapped region.
And if that weren't enough, this was a race. At the very same time, the Atlantic Telegraph Company was working to lay underwater cables across the Atlantic. Whoever connected the continents first would make a fortune, and whoever lost would lose millions of dollars. So to go as fast as possible, Western Union sent out five separate teams, one to British Columbia, one to the Yukon, one to Alaska, and two to Siberia, where George Kennan ended up.
In one part of Siberia, they were so tormented by mosquitoes, they had to wear their mosquito nets night and day, and that even that didn't work. Their hands and faces puff up until you can't even recognize them, and they almost had to suffocate themselves with smoke to have any peace.
The hardship notwithstanding, Kennan loved it in Siberia. He visited nomadic reindeer herders, hunted bears, attended a wedding feast, all while mapping a route through the rough terrain. After 2 years in a tiny outpost on the Siberian coast, Kennan spotted an American whaling ship.
So looking for news, looking for company, he goes on board and the captain says, "Oh, yeah, what are you guys doing?" And Kennan says, "Well, we're building a telegraph line." Captain looks at him and says, "Well, you do realize that the Atlantic telegraph line has been laid, is successful, and is working," which is a horrendous surprise, of course, to Kennan, who is not very happy about it at all. But he realizes it's over. And before he gets the official news, he starts selling off everything he can. He sells off the frozen cucumber pickles and lime juice and the glass insulators and the wire, and there it's done.
It wasn't all for naught, because despite the expedition's ultimate failure, scientific reports that were sent back to the Smithsonian from Alaska made their way to the Senate floor. Secretary of State William Seward had his eye on the region for years, but had been unable to convince lawmakers that it wasn't a worthless wasteland. The Overland Telegraph reports, which described Alaska as vast and fertile, with fur-bearing animals and iron ore, helped change the senators' minds. And on March 30, 1867, the United States purchased Alaska from Russia for $7.2 million. less than the failed telegraph venture cost Western Union.
We're accustomed to thinking about Russia as standing opposite America, geographically, politically, and ideologically. One of the things we found so fascinating about that Western Union story is that it offers another way of thinking about Russia. Russia as our next-door neighbor. And though it can be hard to believe these days, what with a tense situation in Ukraine and ghosts of the Cold War stirring again, there are plenty of instances throughout our history of Americans thinking about Russians not simply as neighbors, but as kindred spirits of sorts.
And so for the rest of the hour today, we're going to trace the ups and downs of America's relationship with Russia. We'll look at the reasons Russia was invoked by both sides in debates over American slavery, as well as by women's rights reformers decades later. We'll ask what really drove the man who came up with the Cold War containment policy and hear from a former Soviet spokesman who tried to change American hearts and minds. But first, the three of us are going to take a few minutes to consider the early days of U.S.-Russia relations.
Now, guys, I have a document here that I think might surprise a lot of listeners, not because of what it says, but because when it was written. It's from Democracy in America, the famous travelogue by the French writer Alexis de Tocqueville. Now, he visited the U.S. in the 1830s, well over a century before the outbreak of the Cold War. And that's what makes this passage sound kind of eerily prescient. Let me read it to you. There are now two great nations in the world, which, starting from different points, seem to be advancing toward the same goal, the Russians and the Anglo-Americans. Tocqueville goes on to say, one has freedom as the principal means of action, the other has servitude. Their point of departure is different, and their paths diverse. Nevertheless, and this is the key part, each seems called by some secret desire of providence one day to hold in its hands the destinies of half the world.
I love the way you read that without a French accent, Ed. That was terrific.
You really wouldn't want to hear that with my French accent. It'd be the southern France. Peter, perhaps I can start with you to help me understand this. You know, is this guy just like freaking brilliant that he could sort of see the course of world history from the 1830s, or is he talking about something other than the history we come to know?
Well, Ed, many people have read those passages as a prophecy of the Cold War, the great clash of ideologies between the two powers of the 20th century. But we need to put Tocqueville in the 19th century when he's talking about 19th century America, the America he visited in the 1830s. And what people were saying at his time about Tsarist Russia. And the one thing I'd point out to you is that invocation of providence, this idea that it is in the inevitable scheme of things as decreed by God. That is, as you, I think you'd agree, very much a 19th century sentiment. Everything is cast in these terms. And the other thing that I think is important is that he talks about great nations, and that's an idea of the 19th century, of powerful nations that have a destiny. We call ours manifest destiny. What may be a shock is to realize that there was an equivalent notion for Tsarist Russia with the Wild East, modern-day Siberia.
Peter, were these nations really great? I mean, these were kind of also-rans, right?
And that's another great point, because we have to think of Russia as a surviving old regime power with a powerful, unconstitutional monarch, the Tsar, who commands the destinies of a whole people. We have to think of, just as there are so many slaves in the United States, there are serfs all over Russia. It's a very unequal hierarchical society. What's remarkable about Tocqueville's prophecy, he says that in the future there's going to be this convergence because equality is the genie that cannot be put back in the bottle. It will affect both great nations in the future. Equality will lead toward domination, toward great power. But equality in Russia? What does
that
mean?
That was my question, Peter. I'm getting ready to throw it right back to you. Yeah. This just seems crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, you do think about this ragtag sort of fake French aristocracy in Russia.
Well, and they speak French. They don't speak Russian.
Yeah, I know. And so how can – I mean, I know he's brilliant. Okay. Right. But how does he see anything emerging out of this? I mean, you know, we're used to the fact that people could somehow see through slavery to a great American future, which is also crazy. But
well, Ed, I think what he sees in the potential for the Tsar has already been fulfilled by the French Emperor Napoleon. This is the immediate background for Tocqueville's experience is the collapse of his world, the old regime in France, and the emergence of a powerful single individual who draws on the nation of France, mobilizes the people of France for world domination. That's, I think, what he has on his mind. If the Tsar were a brilliant genius like Napoleon, he would appeal to the people of Russia. He would mobilize them behind him, and he would overthrow the aristocracy. The king, the Tsar, would overthrow the aristocracy and then unleash all that power across the Asian continent.
So, Peter, are you saying that Tocqueville ends up being such a master predictor because he saw the power of citizens buying into the nation long before anybody else could really put their finger on that phenomenon?
I think that's exactly right, Brian. And there are different kinds of buy-in. In America, you have the buy-in of individual citizens, of patriots. They buy in.
Of literally buying stuff.
Yeah, and they own it. But there's a different kind of buy-in in other nations in the modern world. It's the buy-in of people who gain dignity, who gain a sense of self through the nation that empowers them, or at least psychically provides these rewards. They participate in the great power of their nation. That's what Napoleon modeled, was the apotheosis of French nationality dominating the world in the 19th century. It was a phenomenon. In fact, until the modern wars, the World War I and II, the idea of Napoleonic power was the idea that dominated the historical imagination of the
1960s. Although, ironically, what brought that to an end was his campaign in Russia.
And I think that's great because that gets back to our original prophecy. Why does the United States, why does Russia have this great destiny? And it's because of the land masses. It's because of the potential for development. All they got to do is figure out how to conform the regime to the space, the kind of government to the continent. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today on the show, we're looking at the long history of America's love-hate relationship with Russia.
We were just talking about why Alexis de Tocqueville saw Russia as a fit comparison for the U.S. all the way back in the early 19th century. But it didn't take a foreigner to point out the parallels. Americans were doing it too. There's a long history of Americans using Russia as a kind of rhetorical device when making arguments about their own country. We're going to take a few minutes now to consider that history.
By the 1850s, the Russian Empire and the United States were among the last bastions of unfree labor. Here we had slavery. Over in Russia, they had serfdom, which was basically forced peasant labor. For white Southerners, Russia's adherence to serfdom made the country a kind of twin. One prominent social theorist of the time lamented that Russia and the American South were, quote, the last conservative sections of civilized Christendom.
At the same time, anti-slavery Northerners were invoking Russia to further their cause. In an 1850 speech, Senator William Seward proclaimed Tsarist Russia the most barbarous state in Europe. "Shall we select our institutions," he asked, "from the dominions of the Tsar?"
In 1861, as the U.S. teetered on the brink of civil war, Tsar Alexander II abolished serfdom with a stroke of his pen. The news was greeted with cheers in the American North. And again, we can see the comparisons being made. Listen to this excerpt from an editorial by the anti-slavery newspaperman Horace Greeley.
"The whole world, in all succeeding ages, will applaud the Emperor Alexander for the abolition of slavery in Russia. But what does the world think? What will future generations think of the attempt to make slavery perpetual in America?"
By this time, Abraham Lincoln had established a fairly close relationship with Alexander. The two leaders never met,
But they would sign their letters to each other, "Your good friend," a big diplomatic deal in those days. In the Civil War years, Russia emerged as one of the Union's strongest allies.
But in the 1880s, that coziness began to cool. In editorials, political cartoons, and lectures from the time, you can see a new and much darker image of Russia taking shape. The Tsar may have emancipated the serfs, critics pointed out, but Russians were still living as slaves in a monarchy. Popular writers lambasted the horrors of the Russian Empire, the pogroms that were terrorizing Jews, and the exile of dissenters to Siberia. By the early 1900s, Russia was being cast as an evil empire, one that needed the light of American-style democracy to save itself. David Fogelsong is a historian at Rutgers who has written about this shift, and he says it's no accident this criticism emerged just when it did.
We do see direct arguments about which is worse, lynching inside the United States or pogroms in Russia. But that has to be understood in a broader context where Americans are almost reflexively asking themselves about conditions in Russia. Are they worse or better than Americans? So was the Siberian exile system worse than the problem of the American Indian reservations was a question that was asked.
And so, Fogelsong says, we see yet another instance of Americans looking to Russia for validation, to prove that their cause was right.
As Americans turn away from the traditional isolation to becoming a world power, having Russia as a foil serves to help Americans to define their place and to affirm a positive, active role for themselves in the world.
What was going on in Russia in the latter decades of the 19th century was especially interesting to one particular group of Americans, women's rights reformers. They had their eye on the very prominent role Russian women were playing in the movement to overthrow the Tsar.
When Tsar Alexander II was assassinated, it was by a woman. And there were a number of famous instances of political assassinations that had been undertaken by these female revolutionaries in Russia.
This is historian Julia Mickenberg. She's written about how women in the U.S. praised these sophisticated, well-educated revolutionaries for their bravery and political ambition, and even arranged for some of them to tour the U.S. giving speeches about their struggle. In February of 1917, the long struggle to overthrow the Tsar finally achieved its goal. This wasn't the Bolshevik Revolution that would ultimately lead to the Soviet Union. That would come later. And while these reform-minded revolutionaries were mostly men, they quickly gave Russian women the right to vote.
Julia Mickenberg says that 1917 was a turning point for suffragists. Suddenly, the nation that they had seen as being backwards and oppressive appeared to be more democratic than the United States. Mickenberg told me that one group of suffragists wasted no time in making that contradiction clear. When the revolution hit, they had already been picketing outside the White House.
They were perceived as an annoyance, but nobody was really doing too much about it. But in June of 1917, you had two women hold up a banner that was greeting a delegation from Russia's provisional government who had been invited to the United States to discuss, you know, what Russia's role would be continuing in the war.
This is right after the U.S. has entered the war. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the protest was in June of 1917, and we had just entered the war that April. So these two suffragists held a big banner in front of the White House, and the banner said, "To the envoys of Russia, they say we are a democracy. Help us win a war so that democracies may survive. We, the women of America, tell you that America is not a democracy. 20 million American women are denied the right to vote. President Wilson is the chief opponent of their national enfranchisement. Help us make this nation really free. Tell our government it must liberate its people before it can claim free Russia as an ally."
That banner must have been pre-bumper sticker era. I don't know, you could fit that on a bumper sticker.
No, it's definitely, it's much bigger than a bumper sticker. It's a pretty large banner. So within, you know, a minute of them getting this banner up there, an angry crowd rips the banner down. And this really sets off a tremendous amount of anger because here are women embarrassing the United States in front of a crucial war ally.
Were they accused of being traitors to the war?
Yes, they were accused of being traitors. Interestingly, though, there was a cartoon published shortly after this, and it had a picture of all the chaos in the crowd, and it was captioned, "Making the Russians feel at home, making the Russian envoys feel at home," because they had become so used to all this violence and chaos with the revolution.
Julia, you call this a turning point. Can you spell out exactly why it was a turning point?
This becomes a turning point because this pressed kind of a raw nerve. Part of it was the coincidence of the Russian Revolution and the war. Suffrage is ultimately passed as a so-called war effort, but part of it was that here the country that had been sort of showcased as a bastion of its lack of democracy was giving women the vote before the United States, and this was our ally, and it becomes increasingly a national embarrassment. And suffragists were very savvy about picking up on this.
So later in that year, in October, the Bolsheviks take over. That had to change something, right?
So the Bolshevik Revolution, sometimes called the October Revolution, is received in the United States very differently from the February Revolution. The February Revolution is widely hailed. The Bolshevik Revolution was quite unpopular, and there were fears that this was a tremendous radical takeover. Right after the revolution, Russia withdrew from World War I. They called for the nationalization of all private property. On the other hand, within the suffrage movement, you don't really see any kind of negative reaction to the Bolshevik revolution. Mm-hmm. And in fact, part of that was because the rights for women that had been granted to women under the provisional government were retained by the Bolsheviks. And Lenin especially spoke quite vocally about what the Bolsheviks were doing for women. In 1919, he made this claim that was then, you know, republished in The Nation that, you know, no bourgeois government in the world is doing a tenth of what we're doing for women to release them from household drudgery. They're setting up nurseries for children that would allow women to keep working. Abortion was not only legalized, but made free. Divorce was made much easier. Women could keep their names after marrying. So a kind of slew of regulations passed pretty quickly under the Bolsheviks that were seen by many as benefiting women.
So unlike many other Americans, the suffragists aren't condemning the Bolsheviks. Did they take a lot of heat for that?
Well, yes. Anti-suffragists, known as the antis, really seized upon the Bolshevik Revolution as, look, the suffragists are supporting this clearly dangerous government. We've been saying all along that they're socialists. Now, look, they're supporting these clearly dangerous Bolsheviks. And they just had a field day attacking suffragists. So this was arguably really damaging to the cause of suffragists.
So I'm confused because we know the end of the story. Women do get the vote. Wilson does change his mind.
Right.
Yet you leave us hanging here in 1918, 1919. Things are looking bad for the movement, right? They've been associated with this radical movement in the Soviet Union. And 1919 is known by historians as the Red Scare. What happens?
Well, really, by the fall of 1917, arguably before the Bolshevik Revolution, the passage of suffrage is largely seen as a done deal. And also in the fall of 1917, Wilson gives his support to the suffrage amendment as a war measure.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, arguably, this sort of outcry and this really hammering on the Bolshevik thing can be taken less as an indication that the suffrage movement is in trouble and more as an indication that its opponents are really panicking.
I see.
And trying to do everything they can at this point to make the amendment fail. But what I do think is that the antis did succeed in limiting the feminist agenda, you know, workplace justice or having free childcare available. Those kinds of things are associated with Bolshevism and subversion. And so certainly by the 1920s, tied up with the Red Scare, the National Women's Party and feminism in general has a much more limited meaning.
Julia Mickenburg is a historian at the University of Texas, Austin. We'll link to her article about American women in the Russian Revolution at backstoryradio.org.
For many years in the latter half of the 20th century, one of the words most associated with the subject of U.S.-Russian relations was containment. The idea being that we needed to contain Soviet influence over the so-called non-aligned nations of the world.
Containment was the brainchild of George Frost Kennan, a third cousin of the George Kennan we heard about at the very top of today's show. This George Kennan was a diplomat who spent most of the 1930s in Russia. After World War II, with tensions building between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, Kennan sent a famous 5,500-word telegram to the Secretary of State in which he outlined the existential threat posed by the Soviets to the American way of life. And in 1947, Kennan laid out the solution to this threat in an article for Foreign Affairs magazine under the byline, Mr. X.
This would of itself warrant the United States entering with reasonable confidence upon a policy of firm containment, designed to confront the Russians with unalterable counterforce at every point where they show signs of encroaching upon the interest of a peaceful and stable world.
Put into practice, containment helped shape American military policy in Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And so you may be surprised to hear that Kennan never actually advocated military containment. He thought a military buildup would only provoke the Soviets and favored instead the soft power of policies like the Marshall Plan, which he felt would create a buffer of stable, democratic states around the Soviet Union.
Frank Castiglioa is the editor of a brand new collection of Kennan's diaries. Castiglioa says that the typical Cold Warrior portrait of Kennan belies a man with a deep and longstanding affection for Russia.
Kennan's feelings for Russia and his involvement with Russia was more intense than, I think, I would say more than any other policymaker. There was a kind of a passionate aspect to Kennan's feelings for Russia. There's one passage in the diary when he says, after seeing a Chekhov play, tears come to his eyes, and he says that this brought to the surface my Russian self, which is more genuine than my American self. And that intense attachment, that identification even, is something that persisted throughout Kennan's life. And in a way, I think the task for historians is to explain the Cold War aspects of Kennan, because, you know, the long telegram and the Mr. X article, because in a way, those are the anomalies in decades of certainly loyalty to the United States, but also this emotional identification with the Russians.
So one of the ways that some might explain that Cold War exception, as you call it in Kennan, is the distinction between the Russian people and the Russian government.
I think that's certainly a big part of it. I mean, when Kennan first went to Russia, it was 1933-34, and he just totally loved being in Moscow. He immersed himself in the social scene, knew many Russians, partied with them, went to sporting events and ice skating. And then when Stalin's purges started in 1934, but particularly in 35, 36, those people with whom Kennan had associated, many of them disappeared. These were former heroes of the revolution whom Stalin exterminated. That's something that cut Kennan off from his close access to the Russian people, to Russian intellectuals and ordinary Russians. So that's something that Kennan never forgave. But despite this distaste for Stalin's regime and for communism in general, Kennan's love for the Russian people kind of bled through his political recommendations, because as early as February 1948, when the Cold War is getting more and more militarized, Kennan is already suggesting, well, you know, maybe we've stopped the advance of Russian influence. Maybe someone, and he kind of here describes the qualifications of someone like himself, maybe someone in the U.S. government should begin negotiations with the Soviets, particularly with Stalin, at some kind of a settlement of this Cold War, which was basically just starting. And that was a plea that fell on increasingly deaf ears as the Cold War became entrenched.
If Kennan's more nuanced understanding of the Russian people and the Soviet Union had prevailed on the American side, do you think that would have changed the outcome of history?
I think there still would have been the rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. But I think there might have been several differences. There are various points where things could have gone one way or the other way. And one particular instance was the decision to build a hydrogen bomb, sure, to basically escalate the arms race by building this far more powerful weapon. Now, that's a decision that could have gone either way. There was opinion on either way, responsible opinion. That's the kind of thing where if the United States had not announced a program of building a hydrogen bomb, the Soviets might have also foregone the possibility of building that kind of a bomb. Another kind of turning point is the decision in the late 1950s, which Kennan publicly opposed, to install nuclear weapons in Europe. So I think that there are various turning points in the Cold War where if Kennan had been in charge, the militarization of the Cold War might not have proceeded to the extent mm-hmm. that it did.
Kennan liked to comment on the future, as I understand it. Were there any predictions that Kennan made that seem particularly timely today?
Well, actually, there is one. It really struck me. In January 1997, Kennan made a prediction, which I think has come eerily true just in the past few months. At that point in 1997, the Clinton administration was pursuing a plan to expand NATO eastward, to include Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary. And Kennan thought that was a serious mistake because he thought the Russians would overreact. In fact, I have here a selection from that diary, which I could read to you. It's a short selection.
That would be great.
That the Russians will not react wisely and moderately to the decision of NATO to extend its boundaries to the Russian frontiers is clear. I would expect a strong militarization of Russian political life to the tune of a great deal of hysterical exaggeration of the danger and of falling back into the time-honored vision of Russia as the innocent object of the aggressive lusts of a wicked and heretical world environment. There will be efforts by the Russian leadership to develop much closer relations with Iran and China with a view to forming a strongly anti-Western military bloc as a counterweight to a NATO pressing for world domination. Then he says, thus will develop a wholly and even tragically unnecessary division between East and West, and in effect, a renewal of the Cold War.
Wow. I want to thank you so much for joining us on Backstory today, Frank.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Frank Castigliola is a historian at the University of Connecticut and the editor of The Kennan Diaries.
It's time for a quick break. When we get back, what do you get when you put a Soviet dictator in an American grocery store? A media riot.
This is Backstory, the show where we look at the past to understand the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. Today on the show, we're exploring some of the lesser-known corners of America's history with Russia. For the past few weeks, we've been soliciting your thoughts on the subject at backstoryradio.org, and we called up one of the folks who left us a note.
Hey, guys, gather around. We got a call from Floyd, Virginia, and it's Susan. Susan, welcome to Backstory.
Hi.
Hey, it's great to have you with us, and you've got something on Russia. What is it?
Well, I've always been interested in Civil War history and how medicine mm-hmm. changed around that time.
Mm-hmm.
All this news from Russia, I started looking into the Crimean War when the Tsar decided he was just going to annex a few Ottoman provinces.
Yep.
Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yeah.
It does, doesn't it?
Well, we might have learned some lessons in the Crimean War that maybe apply to the Civil War here.
Yeah.
I was familiar with Florence Nightingale, but I've found the father of field surgery and the first mm-hmm. use of anesthetics.
Yeah,
and none of those were in the United States. Isn't that amazing?
You know, one of the striking things is that the Crimean War probably changed medicine more than the American Civil War did.
And we didn't have triage before that?
Nope.
Well, just the very term triage sounds suspiciously foreign to me. So I'm not surprised by that, Susan.
And we might pause for a moment and remind people when the Crimean War was. And it's in the 1850s, and you know, just a few years before the American Civil War. And as Susan suggests, one of the important things that comes out of it is Florence Nightingale, who basically invented modern battlefield nursing. She actually had this insane idea that cleanliness and sanitation were crucial to health. You know, this is really before they actually have an explanation of the germ theory or anything. But what she did notice that there was these correlations between poor sanitation and poor sewage and so forth and the high battlefield deaths. So
Ed, what does this have to do with us? What does this have to do with the U.S. of A.?
So the United States War, American War, over half the deaths were by disease. And they would have been things that were all attributable to poor sanitation. I mean, what strikes me, Susan, is how little we learn from the Crimea, even though it was all over the newspapers just 5 years before the American Civil War broke out. Florence Nightingale is famous on the front pages of newspapers across the United States. I think they thought that European wars, and certainly wars with people like the Turks, were just a different thing than the Democratic War of the United States was going to be, right? Yeah. And I think there's a certain kind of combination of arrogance and ignorance that they don't really think there's that much to learn from other people about this war until they get into the war, and then the United States Sanitary Commission is all over what Florence Nightingale had done.
Exactly. Yeah, and the thing I would add, Ed, is that it seems to have taken us quite some time on the Union side, which was supposed to be Union, the federal government, the central government. It took them a while to learn the lessons of centralization. It took them a while to understand that, you know, if you just had these doctors and all these separate units, then a lot of them would be sitting around when one battle was going on. They wouldn't be able to, you know, aid from a centralized perspective whatever battle happened to be going on. It strikes me as ironic that the Union took so long to kind of centralize its approach through things like the Sanitation Commission.
And then ironically, another thing which suggests that once the innovation based on the experience of the Crimea did begin, it accelerated very rapidly. You would have had the largest hospital in the world in Richmond at Chimborazo Hospital, basically upon the ideas that Florence Nightingale of centralization, as you're saying, Brian, and sanitation would have taught us.
Right. Hey, Susan, thanks for your provocative question. It's been fun talking to you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
If you're just joining us, this is Backstory, and we're talking about the long history of U.S.-Russia relations. We're going to turn now to a sort of set piece of that history, and that's the early years of the Cold War, when Nikita Khrushchev was the leader of the Soviet Union.
In 1956, Khrushchev famously threatened that his nation would, quote, bury the West. And it was in this context that, in 1959, Khrushchev paid America a visit.
Khrushchev was the first Soviet and Russian leader who visited the United States.
This is Sergei Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev's son. He was 24 at the time and accompanied his father on the trip.
And we tried to find out how Americans live, how they look like. It was like Discovery America. We were like Columbus.
Khrushchev was here to meet with President Eisenhower. But before he did, he spent nearly 2 weeks touring the country. He met with businessmen in New York and farmers in Iowa, and he went out to Hollywood and met with actors. There, he was told right before he gave a speech that he wouldn't be visiting Disneyland, and he could barely contain his disappointment.
Just now, I was told that I couldn't go to Disneyland. I asked, why not?
Может быть, там теперь ракетные площадки созданы?
What is it you have?
По запуску ракет?
Rocket launching pads there?
Я не знаю, да.
I don't know.
The real answer was that local police had gotten skittish about security at Disneyland. But security didn't seem to be that much of a concern a couple of days later when, in San Francisco, Khrushchev's handlers ushered him through the doors of a supermarket.
It was all part of the State Department's plan to show him just how freaking rich we were over here.
This is writer Peter Carlson, who has pored over the media accounts of Khrushchev's 1959 tour. We're going to let Carlson and Sergei Khrushchev narrate the rest of this brief moment of levity in a very dark era.
When they told him about the supermarket and the grocery stores where you can pick your merchandise by yourself, he told, "I want to look how it looks like."
Khrushchev walks in, and he heads for the produce section and starts checking out the potatoes and a cantaloupe. He hit it with his thumb so he could listen to it, like a very astute shopper. And immediately a pack of photographers is shooting pictures. A little old lady who's shopping starts yelling, there's the Russian, the cute fat one. He's besieged with all sorts of shoppers. Housewives hold up their babies to see him, and teenage girls start shrieking, and one of them shakes his hand and then screeches, "He touched me!" It's like Elvis had appeared. The Russian bodyguards, a little freaked out by their leader being mobbed by God knows who these people are, they circle Khrushchev and link arms so that no one can get near him. And so the photographers who want pictures of all this can no longer see Khrushchev behind his huge bodyguards. So they start climbing on shelves so they can get above Khrushchev and shoot down and get a picture.
They're climbing on the shoulders of each other, trying to make the picture or just to hear what he says. It was this crowd was bigger and bigger, and they tried to find and make the photograph and to hear everything there. It was a big crowd.
And then all hell breaks loose, and cans and jars are falling on the floor and smashing, and people are screaming, and I guess they had a refrigerated case full of butter, which would now be behind a door. So some photographer looking for height just climbed right into it and starts stepping in the butter. Somebody else stepped in a meat cabinet and is standing in chicken. It's just a big media riot. It's funny, yeah. I mean, the juxtaposition of funny, strange, bizarre, and surreal scenes like that with scenes of Khrushchev and others talking about nuclear war and how many missiles they have and how many cities they can blow up, it just makes for a very strange portrait of a very scary era.
Permit me in conclusion to wish the American people prosperity and happiness.
I do think that it demystified him. And so the mystique of this sort of 1984 aspect of the Soviet Union was cracked a bit, and we could have a little more nuanced view of what he and they were like.
Goodbye. Good luck. Friends.
That was Peter Carlson with help from Sergei Khrushchev. Carlson's book about Khrushchev's visit is K Blows Top. You can listen to him reading this section about the supermarket visit at our website. We'll also post an earlier story we did there about the Iowa stop on Khrushchev's visit. That's all at backstoryradio.org. I want to see Khrushchev.
If you were watching television in the 1980s, you might remember a Russian pundit named Vladimir Posner. He was a frequent guest on talk shows throughout the decade as Soviet leaders worked to improve their nation's image in the West. He made his first appearance on American television in 1980.
It was with Ted Koppel.
This is Vladimir Posner.
And it was on Nightline. It was live.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Radio Moscow commentator Vladimir Posner.
I got pretty high ratings, and obviously when you get good ratings, you go on again and again.
Here's Posner on Phil Donahue's show a few years later.
Are you a party member? You are, I assume.
You assume. You're right. Yeah, you're right.
You're a real commie.
Uh-huh.
All joking aside, this guy was representing what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire. After decades of horror stories about communist indoctrination, many Americans were wary of anything a Russian had to say.
Who is Vladimir Poznan? Where does he come from? And can we trust him to tell us the truth about the Soviet Union? In the next half hour...
So, who is Vladimir Poznan? Well, Poznan was born in Paris to a French Catholic mother and a Russian Jewish father. He grew up in New York City and didn't move to the Soviet Union until he was a teenager, which is why, in his multiple TV appearances, Poznan spoke like an everyday New Yorker. By the time he popped up on American TV, Poznan had worked for the Soviet state media for years. In the 60s, he edited Soviet Life magazine, a publication that set out to show Russia's good side to Americans. And by the 80s, Poznan had become a commentator for the North American service of Radio Moscow, a state-owned agency. So we asked Poznan if it would be fair to call him, well, a journalist.
Well, I say always that in Soviet times, there were no journalists. People who worked in the mass media in the Soviet Union were referred to officially as soldiers of the ideological front. I'm not kidding you. In other words, you could not be a journalist in the traditionally understood sense of the word in the Soviet Union. We were all propagandists. Our role was to explain and support the policy of the Communist Party.
When I walk up Park Avenue and I see people in the streets, living in the streets, I say to myself, that is not a fair society. That should not be in a society so incredibly rich as the United States. We are a poor society. No one lives in the streets. No one.
As an international spokesman, Poznan says he was allowed a little more leeway to say things that were critical of the Soviet government. But there were limits. Once, Poznan says, he ventured to tell an American interviewer what he really believed about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
And I said, I think that we will regret the decision to go in. This led to my being taken off the air for 6 months, nearly losing my job, and immediately my traveling rights were revoked.
Despite all that, Poznan says he believed in what he was doing and that he saw himself as more than merely a government mouthpiece.
I thought of myself as someone who could change Americans' views about what Russians were like and what the Soviet Union was like. You have to understand, I believed in that system. That's the way my father brought me up. Gradually, that belief began to erode. But I fought to keep it because it's a painful thing to lose what you believe in. You try to find ways to say yes, but, and so on. And I really cared about relations between the two countries. I didn't want Americans to hate or be afraid of Russians, and I didn't want it the other way either. I saw my role as someone who could help the two countries understand each other better at the level of just regular people, not governments.
Now 80 years old, Poznan still pays close attention to the image of Russia offered by American media. And these days, he's not impressed by what he's been seeing. Poznan says that it's all too common for American journalists to revert to familiar stereotypes and simplistic portrayals of their former Cold War rivals. But what we need, he says, is not simply more accurate depictions of Russian society today. Just as important is a fuller accounting of the Russian past.
Well, to understand a country, you have to know it. You have to know its history. Americans have no idea about Russia's history. They have no idea that Russia never had a Renaissance, that it never had a democracy, that it did not have slaves, that it had serfs, and those serfs were Russians, and they were bought and sold by their masters. Without understanding all of that, without understanding that, you can't understand Russian mentality. You cannot hope to understand what Russians are like, and vice versa.
That's Vladimir Poznan speaking to us from Moscow.
We want to know what you thought about today's show. BackstoryRadio.org is where you'll find us online. Our email is backstory@virginia.edu. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr. Whatever the medium, don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, and Jesse Dukes. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Special thanks to Paul Richardson at Russian Life magazine. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties and History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.